Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine for the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulipe. On this week's program, the first of the new year, we raise the virtual curtain of the Corona Radio Theater for the first of three parts of The Machine Stops, a short story by Ian Forster written in 1909 that has some remarkable parallels to life in 2021. It'll be presented by members of the theater company Word for Word. I'll talk with director Gendel Hing Hernandez and with founding artistic director and actor for this production, Susan Harlow, about the production, which is also part of the company's new podcast series. How nice, drama, and not from the cameras of CNN in our streets of the Capitol. Plus, regular contributor Peter Robinson interviews Stanford's thinking man and co-host of Philosophy Talk, Dr. Josh Landy, about how to approach 2021. Stay with us. Well, I think we're still within the reasonable limits of wishing you a happy new year. So, dear listeners, thanks for tuning in and pulling yourself away from the other right coast drama of the week and taking solace with us here on Open Air. All of us here hope you are staying healthy and reasonably happy. Let a new year and a true new era begin on January 20th. Well, let's begin the show today with a return visit from our friends at Word for Word. Susan Harlow is co-founder with Joanne Winter in 1993 of the company, which believes in the power of the short story to provide solace, compassion, and insight into our daily lives. Susan joins me via Zoom for a conversation about their adaptation of The Machine Stops, a science fiction story written in 1909 by British novelist, essayist, and short story writer E.M. Forster, who is perhaps best known for his novels A Room with a View from 1908, Howard's End in 1910, and his greatest success, A Passage to India, written in 1924 and so beautifully adapted to film. She's joined by the director of the podcast, Gendel Hing Hernandez. In The Machine Stops, Forster describes a dystopian world in which humanity has moved underground and relies on a giant machine to provide all bodily and spiritual needs, with each individual living in isolation in a standard room, communicating through a kind of instant messaging video conference apparatus. Sound familiar? Well, Susan, welcome back and Happy New Year to you. Be sure to unmute yourself there, my dear.
Yes. Thank you.
Try that again.
Thank you, and same to you.
Thanks. As I mentioned, the production is directed by Gendel Hing Hernandez, who also joins me via Zoom prior to our broadcast of the story. Gendel, welcome to you, and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. I hope all is well with you. Gendel, now, in preparing for the show, I wasn't familiar with your work, but there's a wonderful short introduction to you on YouTube, filmed as you are being adorably swarmed and interrupted by who I imagine is your young family. That's quite a tribe.
Yes, that is correct. You know, that's part of the job today. Many artists, we got to be parents. And so I got three little ones. I'm a very proud parent. And, you know, I love having the opportunity to be able to mix it up and bring my family into it. And, you know, that's the big joy, especially nowadays that we're all sort of having to spend this time inside with those we love.
Indeed. I hope all is well and healthy with you and your family.
It is. Thank you so much.
And that the challenges of COVID aren't driving you mad with a crew like that at home.
You know, I'm not going to lie. Parenting in the time of COVID is no joke. So yeah, it is challenging. But you know, I really love this community of artists that I'm a part of. Everybody's so supportive. We all check in with one another. We all uplift one another. And it's been really, really great just to see the folks come out and support one another. It makes you feel like you have a family larger than the ones that you spend time at home that are driving you nuts.
Well, by way of introduction for our purposes, you are Havana, Cuba born and have been a Bay Area actor, director, and teaching artist since 1997, working as an actor with, among other Bay Area troupes, Berkeley Rep, Theater Works, Camposanto, San Jose Rep, Center Rep, New Pickle Circus, Theater of No, and many others. Again, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Susan, let's talk first about how you became acquainted with Gendel's work and why you think he was right for this project.
Gendel's right for every project, first of all. I just have to say that. He's an amazing person. He's an amazing father, as you could see on that little clip. That was a year-end ask that Gendel did for us. And I said, oh my gosh, you should just have those kids on, because every time I see Gendel, he's got a child hanging off him somewhere. And but I met Gendel because he first started with our school and library tour. He was an actor in our school and library tour, and then continued on as a teaching artist. And he's just so good with young people. I specifically worked with him a lot. You know, that Word for Word goes to France every year, and we started doing these workshops in France in English. And it's a great, you know, the Word for Word style is a great way to enhance learning another language. And then Gendel came with me to teach, and all of a sudden they had this great idea at the school where we were teaching that he could teach in Spanish. And so we had a couple of great years where we weren't co-teaching, because I was not teaching his Spanish class, but we were co-planning and both of us teaching. And then by that time Gendel was married to his fabulous wife Amanda, and she came and, you know, brought Maceo, their first child. And it's just been a great thing. We really got to know each other so well through that. And it was nothing but a pleasure. And then Gendel also has been an actor in several of our productions. Food Stories was one. The Stories by Lucia Berlin was another. And now is directing as well for us. And in fact, directed this story, The Machine Stops. And we have another podcast that's launching on January 14th on our website, which Gendel directed. It's by Tribal Chair of Federated Indians of Great and Rancheria, Greg Saris. It's called Citizen. So you can look for that. Gendel directed that one too. But it's just been so much fun to work with Gendel every single time. So.
Well, I encourage people to not only look up that YouTube excerpt, but to keep an eye on it. It goes up to Gendel. Podcasting, directing, a vocation of necessity right now, I imagine.
That is correct. Yes, yes. It's been a great challenge. You know, how can we take this art form that we normally have so much fun physicalizing and putting it inside the audience's ear, you know, and that's been a real challenge. You know, I got to give mad props to David Molina, who is our sound mixer and our sound designer, and that man works magic. He did The Machine Stops, and he will also be doing Citizen. I know that he did South Coast Rep's A Christmas Carol. The man is just like a genius with sound, and so you'll hear it, you'll really hear it in this piece. And I think that has really helped us to bring to life this literature that we normally physicalize. It's great.
Right. Well, a hallmark of Word for Word Productions is that changing of the story into a drama and the dividing of the story among several actors, not unlike a play, but unlike a play, those lines may be divided in unusual ways. Susan, tell us a little bit about the adaptation process.
Well, I never like to use the word adaptation. Only, and it came up this morning in a meeting with someone else, so it's funny you say that, because we want people to know that we are performing the story exactly as written, that we have not taken anything out of it. But you're quite right. It is an adaptation for the stage, or in this case, for the podcast. And it's that, you know, a lot of the artistry lies in that. How do you, as people say, how do you decide who says what, you know? How do you make that choice? Because these stories are not written as play scripts. They're not written as plays. and we're turning it into a script, but we're keeping all the narrative. We're keeping, you know, all the attributives, the he says, the she says. And that's where the adventure and the fun lie, I think. And so, you know, each director kind of has that responsibility, and you work with the actors. So always you create a script together. The director may create the script first. You know how many characters you want. You know who peoples the story. Now, there are the main characters always, but, you know, maybe there's a garbage can that you think should speak. And that's really fun to add those kinds of things. Gandel, any chime in?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that is exactly right. You know, I love the challenge of it and the collaborative process. You know, actors would just be like, I think I say that. My character would say that. I think the bird would probably say that. And we sort of negotiate a process. And yeah, it's great what comes out of it. The transformative aspect, and also the characters that you never thought could be there.
Right. I remember when we did Barbara Kingsolver's Rose Johnny, and we met her. She came to do an evening with the author. That was, I think, maybe our first. And it's obvious, you know, there are certain characters that are in the story and they have dialogue, and that's apparent who says that. But we were trying to fill parts also, and Barbara said, well, I never knew that her doll, George Ann, had a life. And Nancy Shelby played that role. And it was just beautiful. Just beautiful. And what you can do with that is amazing. And also, at the same time, you always want to be sure that you're honoring the author's voice. So that's the question in the rehearsal room. You think, because you could go a million ways. You could be incredibly clever with how you break this down. But you always have to go back to, okay, what if Tobias Wolff were in this room, how would he feel about this breakdown, you know? Or Edward P. Jones, what if he were in this room, how would he feel about this breakdown? So that kind of keeps your guiding angel, if as it were.
Yeah, it keeps you grounded. But a lot of times the authors do come and see the pieces, and that's a really...
After we've created it.
After we've created it. Yeah. That is a nerve-wracking experience, let me tell you. But yeah, they love it. They really love to seeing the work come alive. And so, yeah, I think that's exactly right. The grounding aspect is, what is the author's voice? What was the author sort of trying to convey with this story?
There's so much more we can talk about, Ian Forster. Let's continue the conversation next week as we'll air part two. But let's just give a couple of more words about it. In The Machine Stops, right at the outset, though written in 1909, as I mentioned, we have parallels to today. A son calls his mother through this futuristic video device, but wants to see her in person, quote, not through the wearisome machine. Sounds like Zoom fatigue to me.
You know, the first time we did just a kind of a table read. Remember that, Gendel, that first time? And we were just, I want to say this story was suggested to us by a company member, Delia McDougall. She thought it's the perfect thing for now. So we had a table read just to hear it. And I will say we were all kind of looking at each other over Zoom, kind of stunned that it was so accurate to what we were feeling, what we're experiencing right now. You know?
Yeah, that's one of the things that attracted me to it. This is a post-apocalyptic story, right? Mm-hmm. The earth has been charred. Folks have been driven underground or communicate. They're isolated. And it was written in 1909, and it was describing exactly what we were living through right now.
Indeed. And even later, the clumsy system of public gatherings had long since been abandoned. Sounds like quarantine, the closing of public places, performance halls. It's amazing. Let's continue this conversation next week, but we're out of time for now for at least an introduction. Susan Ging, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll continue next week. Thanks, Ging.
Yes, Gendel. Thank you for having us. Thank you so much for having us. Happy New Year.
And to you. We'll be presenting The Machine Stops over the course of the coming 3 weeks. This week's episode is called The Airship. Next week, The Mending Apparatus, followed by The Homeless on January 21st. Let's get started.
The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster. 1. The Airship. Imagine, if you can, a small room, hexagonal in shape, like the cell of a bee. It is lighted neither by window nor by lamp, yet it is filled with a soft radiance. There are no apertures for ventilation, yet the air is fresh. There are no musical instruments, and yet, at the moment that my meditation opens, this room is throbbing with melodious sounds. An armchair is in the center, by its side a reading desk. That is all the furniture. And in the armchair there sits a swaddled lump of flesh. A woman, about 5 feet high, with a face as white as a fungus. It is to her that the little room belongs. An electric bell rang. The woman touched a switch and the music was silent.
I suppose I must see who it is, she thought, and set her chair in motion.
The chair, like the music, was worked by machinery, and it rolled her to the other side of the room where the bell still rang importunately.
Who is it? She called.
Her voice was irritable, for she had been interrupted often since the music began.
She knew several thousand people.
In certain directions, human intercourse had advanced enormously.
But when she listened into the receiver, her white face wrinkled into smiles, and she said, "Very well, let us talk. I will isolate myself. I do not expect anything important will happen for the next 5 minutes, for I can give you fully 5 minutes, Kuno. Then I must deliver my lecture on music during the Australian period." She touched the isolation knob so that no one else could speak to her. Then she touched the lighting apparatus, and the little room was plunged into darkness. "Be quick," she called, her irritation returning. "Be quick, Kuno. Here I am in the dark, wasting my time." But it was fully 15 seconds before the round plate that she held in her hands began to glow. A faint blue light shot across it, darkening to purple, and presently she could see the image of her son, who lived on the other side of the earth, and he could see her. "Kuno, how slow you are."
He smiled gravely.
"I really believe you enjoy dawdling."
"I have called you before, Mother, but you were always busy. You're isolated. I have something particular to say."
"What is it, dearest boy? Be quick. Why could you not send it by pneumatic post?"
"Because I prefer saying such a thing. I want..."
"Well?"
"I want you to come and see me."
Vashti watched his face in the blue plate. "But I can see you," she exclaimed. "What more do you want?"
"I want to see you not through the machine," said Kuno. "I want to speak to you not through the wearisome machine."
"Oh, hush," said his mother, vaguely shocked. "You mustn't say anything against the machine."
"Why not?"
"Mustn't."
"You talk as if a god had made the machine," cried the other. "I believe that you pray to it when you are unhappy. Men made it. Do not forget that. Great men, but men. The machine is much, but it is not everything. I see something like you in this plate, but I do not see you. I hear something like you through this telephone, but I do not hear you. That is why I want you to come. Pay me a visit so that we may meet face to face and talk about the hopes that are in my mind."
She replied that she could scarcely spare the time for a visit.
"The airship barely takes 2 days to fly between me and you."
"I dislike airships."
"Why?"
"I dislike seeing the horrible brown earth and the sea and the stars when it is dark. I get no ideas in an airship."
"I do not get them anywhere else."
"What kind of ideas can the air give you?"
He paused for an instant. "Do you not know 4 big stars that form an oblong, and 3 stars close together in the middle of the oblong, and hanging from these stars, 3 other stars?"
"No, I do not. I dislike the stars. But do they give you an idea? How interesting. Tell me."
"I had an idea that they were like a man."
"I do not understand."
"The 4 big stars are the man's shoulders and his knees. The 3 stars in the middle are like the belts that men once wore, and the 3 stars hanging are like a sword."
"A sword?"
"Men carried swords about with them to kill animals and other men."
"It does not strike me as a very good idea, but it is certainly original. When did it come to you first?"
"In the airship..." he broke off.
And she fancied that he looked sad. She could not be sure, for the machine did not transmit nuances of expression. It only gave a general idea of people, an idea that was good enough for all practical purposes, Vashti thought. The imponderable bloom, declared by a discredited philosophy to be the actual essence of intercourse, was rightly ignored by the machine, just as the imponderable bloom of the grape was ignored by the manufacturers of artificial fruit.
Something good enough had long since been accepted by our race.
The truth is, he continued, that I want to see these stars again. They are curious stars. I want to see them not from the airship, but from the surface of the Earth, as our ancestors did thousands of years ago. I want to visit the surface of the Earth.
She was shocked again.
Mother, you must come, if only to explain to me what is the harm of visiting the surface of the Earth.
No harm, she replied, controlling herself, but no advantage. The surface of the Earth is only dust and mud. No advantage. The surface of the Earth is only dust and mud. No life remains on it. And you would need a respirator, or the cold of the outer air would kill you. One dies immediately in the outer air.
I know. Of course, I shall take all precautions.
And besides...
Well?
She considered and chose her words with care. Her son had a queer temper, and she wished to dissuade him from the expedition. It is contrary to the spirit of the age, she asserted.
Do you mean by that contrary to the machine?
In a sense, but... His image in the blue plate faded. Kuno! He had isolated himself. For a moment, Vashti felt lonely. Then she generated the light, and the side of her room, flooded with radiance and studded with electric buttons, revived her.
There were buttons and switches everywhere. Buttons to call for food, for music, for clothing. There was the hot bath button, by pressure of which a basin of imitation marble rose out of the floor, filled to the brim with a warm, deodorized liquid. There was the cold bath button. There was the button that produced literature. And there were, of course, the buttons by which she communicated with her friends. The room, though it contained nothing, was in touch with all that she cared for in the world.
Vashti's next move was to turn off the isolation switch, and all the accumulations of the last 3 minutes burst upon her. The room was filled with the noise of bells and speaking tubes.
What was the new food like? Could she recommend it?
Has she had any ideas lately? Might one tell her one's own ideas?
Would she make an engagement to visit the public nurseries at an early date, say this day month?
To most of these questions, she replied with irritation, a growing quality in that accelerated age.
She said that the new food was horrible, that she could not visit the public nurseries through press of engagements, that she had no ideas of her own but had just been told one, that four stars and three in the middle were like a man. She doubted there was much in it. Then she switched off her correspondence, for it was time for her to deliver her lecture on Australian music.
The clumsy system of public gatherings had been long since abandoned. Neither Vashti nor her audience stirred from their rooms. Seated in her armchair, she spoke, while they in their armchairs heard her fairly well and saw her fairly well.
She opened with a humorous account of music in the pre-Mongolian epoch, and then she went on to describe the great outburst of song that followed the Chinese conquest. Remote and primeval as were the methods of Ai San So in the Brisbane school, she yet felt, she said, that a study of them might repay the musicians of today. They had freshness. They had, above all, ideas.
Her lecture, which lasted 10 minutes,
was well received.
And at its conclusion, she and many of her audience listened to a lecture on the sea.
There were ideas to be got from the sea. The speaker had donned a respirator and visited it lately.
Then she fed, talked to many friends, had a bath, talked again, and summoned her bed.
The bed was not to her liking. It was too large. She had a feeling for a small bed.
Complaint was useless, for beds were of the same dimension all over the world, and to have had an alternative size would have involved vast alterations to the machine.
Vashti isolated herself.
It was necessary, for neither day nor night existed underground.
And reviewed all that had happened since she summoned the bed last. Ideas? Scarcely any. Events. Was Kuno's invitation an event? By her side, on the little reading desk, was a survival from the ages of litter. One book.
This was the Book of the Machine. In it were instructions against every possible contingency.
If she was hot or cold or dyspeptic or at a loss for a word, she went to the book.
And it told her which button to press. The Central Committee published it. In accordance with a growing habit, it was richly bound.
Sitting up in the bed, she took it reverently in her hands. She glanced round the glowing room as if someone might be watching her. Then, half ashamed, half joyful, she murmured, "Oh, machine, oh, machine," and raised the volume to her lips. Thrice she kissed it. Thrice inclined her head. Thrice she felt the delirium of acquiescence. Her ritual performed, she turned to page 1367.
Which gave the times of the departure of the airships from the island in the southern hemisphere.
Under whose soil she lived.
To the island in the northern hemisphere.
Whereunder lived her son. She thought, I have not the time. She made the room dark and slept. She awoke and made the room light. She ate and exchanged ideas with her friends and listened to music and attended lectures. She made the room dark and slept.
Above her, beneath her, and around her, the machine hummed eternally.
She did not notice the noise, for she had been born with it in her ears. The earth, carrying her, hummed as it sped through silence, turning her now to the invisible sun, now to the invisible stars.
She awoke and made the room light. Kuno?
I will not talk to you, he answered, until you come.
Have you been on the surface of the earth since we spoke last? His image faded. Again, she consulted the book. She became very nervous and lay back in her chair palpitating.
Think of her as without teeth or hair. Presently, she directed the chair to the wall and pressed an unfamiliar button.
The wall swung apart slowly.
Through the opening, she saw a tunnel that curved slightly so that its goal was not visible. Should she go to see her son, here was the beginning of the journey. Of course, she knew all about the communication system. There was nothing mysterious in it. She would summon a car.
And it would fly with her down the tunnel until it reached the lift that communicated with the airship station.
The system had been in use for many, many years, long before the universal establishment of the machine. And of course, she had studied the civilization that had immediately preceded her own.
The civilization that had mistaken the functions of the system and had used it for bringing people to things instead of for bringing things to people.
Those funny old days when men went for a change of air instead of changing the air in their rooms. And yet, she was frightened of the tunnel. She had not seen it since her last child was born. It curved, but not quite as she remembered. It was brilliant, but not quite as brilliant as a lecturer had suggested. Vashti was seized with the terrors of direct experience. She shrank back into her room.
And the wall closed up again.
Kuno, she said, I cannot come to see you. I am not well.
Immediately, an enormous apparatus fell onto her out of the ceiling. A thermometer was automatically laid upon her heart.
She lay powerless.
Cool pads soothed her forehead.
Kuno had telegraphed to her doctor.
So the human passions still blundered up and down in the machine.
Vashti drank the medicine
that the doctor projected into her mouth.
And the machinery retired into the ceiling.
The voice of Kuno was heard.
Asking how she felt?
Better. Then with irritation, But why do you not come to me instead?
Because I cannot leave this place.
Why?
Because any moment, something tremendous may happen.
Have you been on the surface of the Earth yet?
Not yet.
Then what is it?
I will not tell you through the machine.
She resumed her life. But she thought of Kuno as a baby, his birth.
His removal to the public nurseries.
Her own visit to him there. His visits to her.
Visits which stopped when the machine had assigned him a room on the other side of the Earth.
Parents, duties of...
said the book of the machine.
Cease at the moment of birth. P.422327483.
True. But there was something special about Kuno. Indeed, there had been something special about all her children. And after all, she must brave the journey if he desired it. And...
something tremendous might happen.
What did that mean? The nonsense of a youthful man, no doubt. But she must go. Again, she pressed the unfamiliar button.
Again, the wall swung back.
And she saw the tunnel that curves out of sight. Clasping the book, she rose, tottered onto the platform, and summoned the car.
Her room closed behind her.
The journey to the Northern Hemisphere had begun.
Of course, it was perfectly easy. The car approached, and in it she found...
armchairs exactly like her own.
When she signaled...
it stopped.
And she tottered into the lift.
One other passenger was in the lift.
The first fellow creature she had seen face to face for months. Few traveled in these days, for thanks to the advance of science, the Earth was exactly alike all over.
Rapid intercourse from which the previous civilization had hoped so much had ended by defeating itself.
What was the good of going to Pekin when it was just like Shrewsbury? Why return to Shrewsbury when it would all be like Pekin? Men seldom moved their bodies. All unrest was concentrated in the soul.
The airship service was a relic from the former age. It was kept up because it was easier to keep it up than to stop it or to diminish it. But it now far exceeded the wants of the population. Vessel after vessel would rise from the vomitories of Rye or of Christchurch, I use the antique names, would sail into the crowded sky and would draw up at the wharves of the south empty. So nicely adjusted was the system, so independent of meteorology, that the sky, whether calm or cloudy, resembled a vast kaleidoscope whereon the same patterns periodically recurred.
The ship on which Vashti sailed started now at sunset, now at dawn.
But always, as it passed above Rams, it would neighbor the ship that served between Helsingfors and the Brazils, and every third time it surmounted the Alps, the fleet of Palermo would cross its track behind. Night and day, wind and storm, tide and earthquake impeded man no longer.
He had harnessed Leviathan. All the old literature, with its praise of nature and its fear of nature, rang false as the prattle of a child. Yet... as Vashti saw the vast flank of the ship stained with exposure to the outer air, her horror of direct experience returned. It was not quite like the airship at the Cinematophote. For one thing, it smelt, not strongly or unpleasantly, but it did smell. And with her eyes shut, she should have known that a new thing was close to her. Then she had to walk to it from the lift, had to submit.
To glances from the other passengers.
The man in front dropped his book. No great matter.
But it disquieted them all.
In the rooms, if the book was dropped, the floor raised it mechanically.
But the gangway to the airship was not so prepared.
And the sacred volume lay motionless.
They stopped. The thing was unforeseen.
And the man,
instead of picking up his property,
felt the muscles of his arm to see how they had failed him.
Then someone actually said with direct utterance,
"We shall be late."
And they trooped on board,
Vashti treading on the pages as she did so. Inside, her anxiety increased. The arrangements were so old-fashioned and rough. There was even a female attendant to whom she would have to announce her wants during the voyage.
Of course, a revolving platform ran the length of the boat, but she was expected to walk from it to her cabin.
Some cabins were better than others, and she did not get the best. She thought the attendant had been unfair, and spasms of rage shook her.
The glass valves had closed. She could not go back. She saw, at the end of the vestibule, the lift in which she had ascended, going quietly up and down, empty. Beneath these corridors of shining tiles were rooms, tier below tier, reaching far into the earth.
And in each room, there sat a human being, eating or sleeping or producing ideas.
And buried deep in the hive was her own room.
Vashti was afraid. Oh, machine! She murmured and caressed her book and was comforted.
Then the sides of the vestibule seemed to melt together, as do the passages that we see in dreams. The lift vanished. The book that had been dropped slid to the left and vanished. Polished tiles rushed by like a stream of water. There was a slight jar, and the airship, issuing from its tunnel, soared above the waters of a tropical ocean. It was night. For a moment, she saw the coast of Sumatra, edged by the phosphorescence of waves, and crowned by lighthouses, still sending forth their disregarded beams. These also vanished, and only the stars distracted her.
They were not motionless, but swayed to and fro above her head, thronging out of one skylight into another, as if the universe and not the airship was careening.
And, as often happens on clear nights, they seemed now to be in perspective, now on a plane, now piled tier beyond tier into the infinite heavens, now concealing infinity, a roof limiting forever the visions of men.
In either case, they seemed intolerable.
Are we to travel in the dark?
Called the passengers angrily.
And the attendant,
who had been careless,
generated the light and pulled down the blinds of pliable metal.
When the airships had been built, the desire to look direct at things still lingered in the world.
Hence the extraordinary number of skylights and windows.
And the proportionate discomfort to those who were civilized and refined.
Even in Vashti's cabin, one star peeped through a flaw in the blind, and after a few hours' uneasy slumber, she was disturbed by an unfamiliar glow, which was the dawn.
Quick as the ship had sped westwards, the earth had rolled eastwards quicker still and had dragged back Vashti and her companions towards the sun. Science could prolong the night, but only for a little, and those high hopes of neutralizing the earth's diurnal revolution had passed, together with hopes that were possibly higher, to
keep pace with the sun,
or even to outstrip it, had been the aim of the civilization preceding this.
Racing aeroplanes had been built for the purpose, capable of enormous speed, and steered by the greatest intellects of the epoch. Round the globe they went, round and round, westward, westward, round and round, amidst humanity's applause.
In vain.
The globe went eastward quicker still. Horrible accidents occurred,
and the committee of the machine,
at the time of rising into prominence,
declared the pursuit illegal, unmechanical, and punishable by homelessness.
Of homelessness, more will be said later.
Doubtless the committee was right.
Yet the attempt to defeat the sun aroused the last common interest that our race experienced about the heavenly bodies, or indeed about anything. It was the last time that men were compacted by thinking of a power outside the world. The sun had conquered, yet it was the end of his spiritual dominion. Dawn, midday, twilight, the zodiacal path touched neither men's lives nor their hearts, and science retreated into the ground to concentrate herself upon problems that she was certain of solving.
So when Vashti found her cabin invaded by a rosy finger of light, she was annoyed and tried to adjust the blind.
But the blind flew up altogether.
And she saw through the skylight small pink clouds swaying against a background of blue.
And as the sun crept higher, its radiance entered direct, brimming down the wall like a golden sea.
It rose and fell with the airship's motion, just as waves rise and fall. But it advanced steadily as a tide advances. Unless she was careful, it would strike her face. A spasm of horror shook her, and she rang for the attendant.
The attendant, too, was horrified, but she could do nothing. It was not her place to mend the blind. She could only suggest that the lady should change her cabin.
Which she accordingly prepared to do.
People were almost exactly alike all over the world, but the attendant of the airship, perhaps owing to her exceptional duties, had grown a little out of the common.
She had often to address passengers with direct speech, and this had given her a certain roughness and originality of manner.
When Vashti swerved away from the sunbeams with a cry, she behaved barbarically.
She put out her hand to steady her.
How dare you?
Exclaimed the passenger.
You forget yourself.
The woman was confused and apologized for not having let her fall.
People never touched one another. The custom had become obsolete, owing to the machine.
Where are we now? Asked Vashti haughtily.
We are over Asia, said the attendant, anxious to be polite.
Asia?
You must excuse my common way of speaking. I have gotten into the habit of calling places over which they pass by their unmechanical names.
Oh, I remember Asia. The Mongols came from it.
Beneath us, in the open air, stood a city that was once called Shimla.
Have you ever heard of the Mongols and of the Brisbane school?
No.
Brisbane also stood in the open air.
Those mountains to the right? Let me show you them.
She pushed back a metal blind. The main chain of the Himalayas was revealed.
They were once called the Roof of the World, those mountains.
What a foolish name.
You must remember that before the dawn of civilization, they seemed to be an impenetrable wall that touched the stars. It was supposed that no one but the gods could exist above their summits. How we have advanced, thanks to the machine.
How we have advanced, thanks to the machine, said Vashti.
How we have advanced, thanks to the machine, echoed the passenger who had dropped his book the night before.
And who was standing in the passage. And that white stuff in the cracks, what is it?
I have forgotten its name.
Cover the window, please. These mountains give me no ideas.
The northern aspect of the Himalayas was in deep shadow. On the Indian slope, the sun had just prevailed. The forests had been destroyed during the literature epoch for the purpose of making newspaper pulp, but the snows were awakening to their morning glory, and clouds still hung on the breasts of Kinchinjunga. In the plain were seen the ruins of cities, with diminished rivers creeping by their walls, and by the sides of these were sometimes the signs of vomitories, marking the cities of today. Over the whole prospect, airships rushed, crossing the intercrossing with incredible aplomb and rising nonchalantly when they desired to escape the perturbations of the lower atmosphere and to traverse the roof of the world.
We have indeed advanced, thanks to the machine,
repeated the attendant, and hid the Himalayas behind a metal blind.
The day dragged wearily forward.
The passengers sat each in his cabin, avoiding one another with an almost physical repulsion and longing to be once more under the surface of the earth.
There were 8 or 10 of them, mostly young males, sent out from the public nurseries to inhabit the rooms of those who had died in various parts of the earth.
The man who had dropped his book was on the homeward journey. He had been sent to Sumatra for the purpose of propagating the race.
Vashti alone was traveling by her private will.
At midday, she took a second glance at the earth. The airship was crossing another range of mountains, but she could see little, owing to clouds.
Masses of black rock hovered below her and merged indistinctly into gray. Their shapes were fantastic. One of them resembled a prostrate man.
No ideas here, murmured Vashti.
And hid the Caucasus behind a metal blind.
In the evening, she looked again.
They were crossing a golden sea in which lay many small islands and one peninsula.
She repeated, no ideas here.
And hid Greece behind a metal blind.
King Hernandez, with an original sound design by David Molina, and was performed by Carla Gallardo, Susan Harlow, David Everett Moore, Brian Rivera, and Ryan Tasker. Delia McDougall was dramaturge, and sound engineering by Joe Moore. Production manager, Cole McNally. Presented as part of our Corona Radio Theater on open air and available as a podcast at wordforword.org. Next week, part two of The Machine Stops. Join us for The Mending Apparatus, followed by, on the 21st, the third and final installment, The Homeless. We'll also continue our conversation about E.M. Forster with Word for Word co-founder Joanne Winter. Again, learn more about the Word for Word podcast offerings at zspace.org. I'm David LaTulipe, your host for Open Air, and I'm very pleased to say the Imagineer who came up with Corona Radio Theater. I hope you're a fan. And if you're a fan of radio drama, don't forget that KALW broadcasts LA Theater Works on Friday evenings at 8. This week, End Days by Deborah Zoe Laughrin, in which a suburban family undergoes a spiritual crisis following the September 11th attacks. That's LA Theater Works tomorrow night at 8. Next on Open Air, some philosophizing about this new year of 2021. And who better to dialogue on the topic than our regular armchair philosopher and commentator, Peter Robinson. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. Good to see you.
And yeah, thank you. Happy New Year to you. And joined by an actual philosopher and fellow host here at KALW, Dr. Josh Landy of Philosophy Talk. Josh, welcome to the Thursday afternoon end of things here on KALW.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Sure. I hope all is well with you and your family.
Absolutely.
I leave you now to the hands of Peter Robinson for a chat about 2021.
Yeah, hi, Josh. Good to see you.
Nobody
else can see you, but I can see you, and I can see what you're thinking. So I'm going to do a bit of telepathy here, because I'm looking forward to a philosophical year, and you're going to help me and guide me through the minefields. So my first decision is, should I be a Stoic or should I be an Epicurean?
That's a lovely question.
So after last night, I don't know what I want to be, to tell you the truth. The Stoic may be detached and really not involved. Now, the Epicurean may go in pursuit of pleasure, but let's go a little deeper into this. How would you interpret them?
Well, you know, they're both kind of attractive. I mean, it does depend on how much you value peace of mind versus goodness. They both believe in both. Right, they both want us to do good things and to achieve peace of mind, but the balance is a little bit different. And the Stoics think, you know what, get involved, do politics. I mean, Marcus Aurelius was an emperor, for goodness sake, whereas the Epicureans were more about, you know, maybe don't get as involved in the public sphere. Stick to your garden. So, for 2021, maybe Stoicism.
Okay. Now, Marcus Aurelius, of course, gave us the serenity prayer, but out of that came the concept of, I believe, living in the moment. So with things happening so fast in this year of Zoom and doom, that's how I describe it, Zoom and doom, should we be focused on today and, well, let tomorrow come when it comes? How do you feel about that one?
Yeah, I call it the Zoomo scene. I'm just going to give you my opinion on this. I'm a little bit skeptical about that. I mean, I think it works great if you're an actual monk, and I'm not knocking that at all. I think doing that is an absolutely fantastic way of life. But for most of us who aren't full on living the monastic life, you can't really live in the moment, because the decisions you make for right now, for this moment, depend on what your plans are. And so, you know, it's a point that Augustine made. It's a point that another philosopher, Husserl, made. There really isn't any such thing as the present moment that's completely divorced from the past and the future. So think about what we're dealing with right now. How long is this thing going to last? Well, we don't really know. And that affects the way we live in our day to day.
It's going to last for 9 more minutes if we get a move on. So there we go. Now, I've been listening to this tune by Bob Dylan called Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. And I think this concept of don't think twice speaks to me a little bit about intuition. Mm-hmm. And how does intuition fill in terms of philosophy?
I think thinking twice is often a very good idea. I mean, intuition is really important, but, you know, it can really mislead us. And that's why we need our reason to come in to make sure we're not just indulging our biases. You know, it's something Descartes told us. It's something Daniel Kahneman tells us. Something Jennifer Eberhardt tells us with the notion of implicit racial bias. Our intuitions aren't always right. So, yeah, my thought about it is think twice.
Now, I know, you know, when you're not talking to me now, you're planning your next philosophy talk. And, you know, I like the tagline for that for everybody, including the intelligent person. And I'm just wondering, with the diverse range of subjects, give me a couple of examples of what we might hear in upcoming philosophy talks.
Well, you know, we've got one coming up on with the mathematician about gerrymandering. How do we actually use mathematics to make our elections fairer in general, not just gerrymandering, but across the board? We've got a show coming up with Adrian Dow, my colleague, about Silicon Valley's rhetoric, the kind of thinking that they draw on or misdraw on. And we will have our annual philosophical movie of the year show. There should be some fun things to come.
Good. And I know you're going to be later in the year speaking at the Marin Philosophical Society, which is a group for thinking people. If you like to think about thinking and you want to have a widespread, you know, that's what we do there. For example, on Martin Luther King's Day, we've got Dr. Gary Wasserman speaking about the impact of race on both the Democratic and the Republican parties. But you're going to be talking later in the year about the combination of self and, I want to use the word imagination, story and self. Yeah. And what does that entail?
Well, the short answer is whenever we think about who we are, if you ask someone, tell me something about yourself, you get two kinds of answers. And one kind of answer is things that have a story, like where you came from, what your plans are, stuff like that. And another set of answers are things that don't have a story, that your likes and dislikes, your capacities. Well, I'm really bad at tennis, but I'm not so bad at snooker. And, you know, I really love fishing or whatever it is. And somehow both of these things form part of our self-conception. So how should we think about those two things? And do they sometimes collide and come into conflict? Who am I really? That's the deep question there.
And who would you like to be today?
I think I'd like to be your fellow Brit.
Okay, there we go. Now, well, actually, when I think back to the years at Cambridge, you know, the name Bertrand Russell immediately springs to mind.
Yes.
And he in fact was alive until 1970, quite extraordinary the life he lived. And beyond all his books on philosophy, what I saw him really is as a pacifist. In the First World War, he was in jail. And throughout the 1960s, he ran a campaign against the war in Vietnam. So sometimes actions are sometimes louder and clearer than thoughts. And is there a connection between those two?
Oh, it's a beautiful question. And I think sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, we had a wonderful guest on recently, Eric Schwitzgebel from UC Riverside, who's basically saying, listen, don't get too excited about philosophy making you a better person. They did a study of the library books least likely to get returned in philosophy. And guess what? They're moral philosophy books. So, and, you know, Heidegger, of course, famously joined the Nazi party. On the other hand, here's an interesting thing. He did this study where they taught students about the meat industry, and then they sneakily spied on their behavior at the cafeteria. They were able to get the data from their purchases the following week. Guess what? They were eating less meat. So sometimes philosophy can actually have an influence on the things that we do. And I think that may have been the case for Russell too.
Yeah, well, before I thank you, just remind me when philosophy talk goes out on KLW. Is it
Sunday morning at 11?
Sunday at 11,
yes,
okay.
Indeed.
And for those who are interested in the Marin Philosophical Society, a good number to call is 415-381-6671 or go to their website. But first, thank you for giving me your insights and making my year look more sparkly, be it Epicurean or be it Stoic. Now, somebody who's got a lot on his mind at the moment is our good president or our bad president. And maybe this is what he's thinking about. It's a tune you'll recognize, but this time we've actually changed the words. So here we go. 50 ways to leave the White House.
What's admitting that your life's cost? Grow a pair and backtrack. Let go of that plot you got. There's no foul play. We can help you look for the door. That's what elections are for. On your very last pray day, just hit the highway. So do your little bow flout and have a little Mont Blanc. It will not a thing bring, however you claim. Swing away to your coast, folks. That's first and foremost. This country's not a king thing, even though it might sting. You know it grieves me so to see you cause more pain. So there was something that we did so we care not occur again. And it is not a big surprise. We must repeatedly explain about the 50 ways. We watched you lie and cheat your way through life for all these years. And then you used the same approach to play upon the country's fears. But now all that is done. Can't you hear the cheers? There must be 50 ways to leave the White House. 50 ways to leave the White House. When that you weren't picked, clicks, climb over that tall wall. There's nowhere to hide by, then knows the White House. Just take a little backpack, or wait for the blackjack. It's two without a doubt out, both you and your spouse. This is a required fire, get over your denied lie. You're about to be long gone, cause your eyes got beat. Got the dead wanna lose blues, something you cannot refuse. So throw out the cheat sheet, make your final tweet.
50 ways, indeed, the way we leave the White House. Thank you for that, Peter. How about just get impeached, leech? Or get on the chopper, flopper. I think we could all come up with a few additional lyrics for that. Thank you for contributing once again to Open Air. We'll talk with Peter later in the month, as usual. I'm David Mottini. Thanks so much for listening to Open Air. A reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. Send me an email, david@kalw.org, if you've got some comments or suggestions. Future show segments. My thanks to Neil Swickles for producing the show and to the team at KALW Studios, Joanne Marr and Damien Meyer for handling the controls and making the show run smoothly this first show of 2021. Join me next week at the same time for Open Air. I'll be talking with Ming Luke of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. You'll also hear part two of The Machine from our friends at Word for Word. Tune in for that. That and more, maybe a birthday tribute late to the composer Poulenc, Francis Poulenc, who was born on this date, along with Jean-Pierre Rampal, both celebrating their birthdays. Once again, our shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks so much for listening. And next week, do tune in to Open Air. A reminder that Philosophy Talk can be heard not only Sundays at 11, but Tuesday evenings at 6. Thanks so much for listening.